Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Finally, it just hit me. You know what's really going on here is that the bulk of the population can't float candidates of their own. In other words, politics costs a lot of money. And another way of putting it is the conventional approach where you start talking about democratic theory is, well, we're all sort of sitting around a tree or something, and are in maybe the town square in Lexington, Massachusetts, having a town meeting. Stuff's all crap. What you actually got here are huge costs, and they're beyond the ability of most of the population to bear unless they're organized. And then you go from there. It's very easy to show how in effect, power will pass by default to blocks of large investors.
Hey, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we'll be speaking with Thomas Ferguson, an American political scientist and professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Professor Ferguson, well, let me give you some background. First, by saying that the topic he covers, generally speaking, is big money in politics, and that money's impact on the outcome of elections. Now, this probably sounds like something everyone already knows about, right? Well, within academic studies of political science and economy, even journalism, this is considered heresy. But Thomas believes that, yes, big money does, to some extent, decide electoral outcomes, but not in a sort of grand conspiracy style way. He is perhaps most known for his book on the subject, Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Party Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. He joins us on this edition of the program to discuss his research and give his take on the upcoming 2020 U.S. election. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome to Parallax Views, Thomas Ferguson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. How are you doing today, Thomas? We're going to be talking about a lot of things, but first I want to know, how are you doing in this crazy time of pandemics and wildfires?
Right? So I'm here. That's the most important thing. I mean, it's like in phone conversations or interviews, the most important thing you learn in the first 5 seconds. Is there anybody out there? I'm still here. You know?
Well, so that's good.
I think I'm doing fine, thank you. Although I would, you know, in technical terms, I'd say it's sort of a local happy situation and a global disaster.
That's a good way to put it. I wanted to have you on the show because you have a lot to say about the issue of big money in politics. You, of course, helped develop a theory known as the investment theory of party competition. Maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar, you could explain what that is and how you came to this theory.
Okay, well, let me just, I might do this semi-autobiographically. When I was in grad school at Princeton, I started working on these voter controlled models, so-called median voter models. Remember, the median voter is like the 51st voter in a row of 100, where supposedly all the parties have to go to converge there. And it didn't take me long to figure out, come on, this is not the world we're living in. I mean, this is, you know, mid-70s, right in the middle of the 73-74 recession and a little after, as everything goes to pieces and they make the big turn in the way U.S. wages and salaries as a percent of the national income start dropping. And so somebody said to me one day, you know, Ivy Lee's papers are in Mudd Library at Princeton. And I said, that's interesting. I knew who Ivy Lee was. He was one of the two founders of modern public relations. The other founder was Edward L. Bernays, who was insanely Sigmund Freud's nephew. I am not making this up. But Lee was the famously the publicity guy who told John D. Rockefeller Sr. to start giving out dimes to change his public image and then did lots of work. So I thought this ought to be pretty interesting. Why don't I go over, and we're a little short of facts on American politics. And so I went over there, and within about 5 minutes, I had come up with a document where Lee is talking to Franklin Roosevelt right in the middle of the first New Deal. That's fall of 1933, right after Roosevelt won the 32 election, came in early 33. And Roosevelt is just sitting there talking about how he wants to get the U.S. dollar down. He needs to get it. And he's been talking to these entrepreneurs who are telling him this is great. People are buying cars again, et cetera. And I'm sitting there thinking, now I've listened to all these studies coming out of about 100 yards from me where I was sitting right then in the Princeton Economics Department. That was a real old famous monograph by Stephen Clark, who wrote a thing on how was on New Deal monetary policy, let's say, and exchange rates. And he says, you know, Henry Morgenthau, who was Secretary of the Treasury, though not right then, and Roosevelt had no idea what they were doing. And I just like, and I'm sitting there, and this guy is, he's not an international economist, but he's got a perfectly lucid understanding, a non-technical understanding of exactly what's going on. And I said to myself, if I said this to people, they'd say I was crazy. And I remember when I showed up later at MIT, I was teaching, and I was talking to Charles Kindleberger. And, you know, he had some trouble believing it, too. He'd actually worked in the Fed at that point. But, you know, facts are facts. And so I spent a long time in archives all over. And many years later, my wife said to me, can't you do something besides archives? You know, and so I went out and I did a lot of statistics. But anyway, here's the point. If you get past what the historians say, because most of them don't do much primary source material, and that problem has gotten much worse in the last generation because everybody's rushing out their books. I've seen a number of books that who's, you know, well-known guys who should know better, and they just write stuff that's plain false. So I said, all right, we got to make sense of this. How can I start to think about this? And then I said to myself, well, all right, what's going on in the Democratic Party at this point? Because on the one hand, it's definitely pro-labor by comparison with, say, where it had been 10 years before or with the Republicans at any point, and especially after the second New Deal, the 35-36 sort of New Deal that really stamped the Roosevelt policies out there. Then I started building little accounts of who's financing Roosevelt's reelection. And basically, at that point, I was by then down in Texas, teaching at the University of Texas. I mean, I went from Princeton to MIT and then thence to Texas. Right? And I actually stayed in the house of one of the Texas oilmen who was helping to finance Roosevelt. And he gave me his papers. I've written this up. It's in a paper called Normalcy to New Deal and International Organization for 1984, and it's in my book, Golden Rule. So I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking suddenly, you know what? This is a case of the capital-intensive industries don't necessarily like labor unions, but they'll live with them, whereas the labor-intensive guys can't. That builds me. And then a little later, I got sort of understood the importance of the trade issue. And so then I said, what you need here is to understand divisions within the business community and how social movements affect them. So you need a sort of, this is a jawbreaker, but I'll try it, a comparative static model that allows you to see what happens when there's social turmoil. And you can imagine a party being tossed left or tossed right. So I started building these accounts in which particular business sectors are important actors. And then finally it just hit me. You know what's really going on here is that the bulk of the population can't float candidates of their own. In other words, politics costs a lot of money. And another way of putting it is the conventional approach where you start talking about democratic theory is, well, we're all sort of sitting around a tree or something, and are in maybe the town square in Lexington, Massachusetts, having a town meeting. Stuff's all crap. What you actually got here are huge costs, and they're beyond the ability of most of the population to bear unless they're organized. And then you go from there. It's very easy to show how, well, in effect, power will pass by default to blocks of large investors. And then your whole trick there is to actually find empirically, meaning what are the facts about who's lining up with whom. And so in the 80s and 90s, I was working on the Federal Election Commission data by hand, which was the only way you could do it, pretty much. And then so I started writing that stuff up. Now, in the last, 10 years or so, I am in the happy position of working with two very good researchers, Ji Chen and Paul Jorgensen, where we can download a lot more data. You still have to work it heavily over, but you can produce a lot of stuff. My favorite finding, the one I love, because it just enrages so many political scientists and not economists just laugh. Reporters are sort of stunned. But what we found out was if you actually look at the percentage of money in major party contested elections for the House and the Senate, you quickly discover that, in fact, the relationship between money and winning is actually a straight line. And we first found that relation for 2012. And this was after a spate of articles by people who should have known better saying, well, there wasn't any relation between the House elections and that. So, okay, straight line. The response we got was, well, you know what? That must be because the money's following the votes, not the votes, the money. And, you know, actually, you're going to find effects both ways, but you should be able to try to parcel those out. And so the challenge was how to do that. And what we did in our most recent paper was to show you that, okay, how can you get at what people thought was going to happen? And there's a big movement in economics. I don't want to be misunderstood here. I don't think that gambling odds tell you what's going to happen.
Lot of people say that it's more like gambling odds.
Yeah. If you want to guess at what conventional expectation is, though, gambling odds are pretty good. They're much better data than anything else. And they follow the polls pretty closely, actually, with a few exceptions. Early on, they don't. Later, they do, usually. I mean, we can go on forever, but this is the heart of the matter is that. And what we show you, we take you through a couple of cases. 1994, when the Republicans suddenly took over the House in an absolute shocker. And then in 2016, in the Senate race. And basically what we do is we plot the money coming in against the gambling odds. You can see very clearly that with like 3 weeks to go, Mitch McConnell was cooked, although there wasn't too much writing about it. Reporters who were, they were saying they were cooked. They were talking about going down with their guns blazing and things like that. Then they poured in a ton of money. And I've met Democratic senators who lost in those elections who told me, yeah, we were ahead. And then we saw all this money come in the last 3 weeks and got blown out. I think there we settled the question. You know, there were no secret polls that were showing the Republicans up. All the polls were showing them down. The gambling odds reflected that. They were way down. And, you know, we'll come back to this when we get around to talking about 2020, because this same type of effort to retain the Senate in the face of possibly losing the presidency is clearly underway again. It's happening now. But anyway, I think we've eliminated the sort of basic objection there that, yeah, money drives votes and votes drive money, but mostly money drives votes. I mean, that's the big story.
If I could, real quickly, sure. I wanted to say something that I find interesting. You say the conventional sort of wisdom, but it's interesting to me. I think with political scientists, the investment theory of party competition has been seen as controversial. It goes against the median voter theorem. But for voters, I think this is almost like common knowledge, you know?
Yes.
Big money in politics. Yeah.
Now, look, I once was asked, could I give some lectures on a boat, a fairly large boat? Because somebody, effectively, I was going to be like the equivalent of the entertainment. I mean, you know, they had probably some guys doing animal shows or something. And no, then there was Mike. So I must have had a quarter of the boat by the end of the time there. I was just talking about politics and money. And you look at polls, most of the population thinks that big money really talks. Now, this actually begins to get pathological in the following sense. I mean, people are all sort of, there's all this wave after wave of what I and probably everybody else would regard as nutty conspiracy theories around really crazy stuff. Why does that? It's not just in the United States. It's all over in Europe. I have no access to Russian stuff, but I bet it's there too. And so the question is, why this proliferation of this stuff? And I think the answer is very straightforward. Part of it is the nature of the world. You're living in highly polarized economic times, in which the 1% or their equivalent are just walking off with more and more of everything there is to walk off with in the economy. And people know that, but they are not receiving an explanation in, you know, there are only a few places you can get it. The mass media, from politicians, maybe you might pick up a bit in your university or something like that if you go through it, but that's most folks are not, you can't deal with it. So, why does this stuff proliferate? It's because the analysis of power is so sophomoric in the mass media. It doesn't matter whether it's left or right mass media. You know, it's equally stupid in terms of how the sort of mechanical picture of how the world works. When do you get a serious article about what this or that industry wants and what they've done to do it? You get one-sided pictures. I mean, in the 2016, the Democrats had gone to great lengths with a bunch of media folks to sort of set up a thing. It was going to be Hillary Clinton versus the Kochs. And then suddenly it wasn't. I mean, I tried to tell people that, look, you've got to do better than just focusing on a single group, however powerful and significant they are, they matter. But this is not the way our system works. You need a kind of general approach. Well, anyway, that's where the investment theory comes from. And the key point in the investment theory is it can be reduced to a single sentence. It's that you can only make public appeals that you can finance. And if you can't finance them, it doesn't matter how many people would benefit from them. You can't reach them. And folks typically, in a sort of mental sleight of hand, typically, they just wash out that small detail about just how expensive getting into politics is. You know, I mean, I remember back in the late 80s, late 70s, really, and early 80s, there was this talk about maybe we're going to have a monopolized media as they deregulated and removed all the public fairness rules and things like that.
The fairness doctrine.
And I remember when Mario Cuomo, of happy memory, was saying, well, this is no problem. I mean, now anybody can buy a station that wants to. You know, I heard that and I just, come on. And that was the Democratic response to the Republicans there. You know, that's just nuts. And the sort of big story in American politics in the last few years, I think, is the advent of real small donor political movements. Now, they occur on both the right and the left. Trump had significant political support, as Jorgensen, Chen, and I showed in our papers on 2016. But, you know, the big money into Trump was huge. And if you try to mix big and small money, what happens is it becomes like sort of public-private partnerships for doing some kind of city thing. That is to say, they take the city money and then the private guys get the cash benefits of it. If you have small donors go into coalition with a bunch of big donors, you have a problem because those folks don't have the same objectives, especially on tax policy, I think above all, but also just in general public goods of all types. As a guy on Wall Street actually said to me once, why should I pay for anybody's education? I can hire anybody in the world I want. So in the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, or if you like, the Sanders AOC wing of the Democratic Party, now really is a small donor funded. I had a little bit of disbelief myself when my colleagues and I ran the numbers back in 2016. We thought, well, there's surely going to be some big donors sitting there. No, there wasn't.
Wow.
We're in the process of doing 2020 now, but it's obvious there wasn't. And you can see inside the big story in American politics, besides the Trump Democratic split and the Trump versus the rest of the Republican stuff, is this emergence of a genuine small donor funded base in the Democratic Party. That's a biggie. And to the extent they have success in actually knocking off incumbents in the Democratic Party, they will change the party. And you can see it's been a ferocious fight. It was remarkable, though, the way, say, in Massachusetts, Senator Markey was way down against Joe Kennedy.
Now, and he beat him. Yeah.
He beat him when AOC and company showed up virtually, as it were, to push him. And then Nancy Pelosi came in on the side of Joe Kennedy. Well, I mean, Kennedy lost.
The Kennedys usually don't lose in Massachusetts, is what
it turned a lot of heads. Similarly, the Engel result in New York, where I think Bowman won that race. Jamal Bowman is, I think, the guy who won. And there are some other ones running around. There's this incredible irony. We're living in this very strange interregnum right now, in which essentially just before COVID hit and made everybody suddenly realize that the most important issue of the Sanders campaign, Medicare for All, was dead on target. It's exactly what you need to cope with this. It had been defeated. And, you know, the irony of this was, you know, the black congressional leadership in the South joined with the Biden campaign to secure that defeat. Now we've got COVID raging. It's raging all over, but black and Hispanic and poor communities are really disproportionately hit. You know, it's a strange situation where it's obvious to even more people now, you know, you really need single payer.
In a way, COVID has benefited this Bernie AOC wing in a way.
Yeah, it has. But, you know, you're given the rules of the system and the way it works. You've got a presidential candidate, you know, who's not in favor of it on the Democratic side. And, of course, the Republicans are not in favor of it. To say they're not in favor of it hardly, you know, that's crazy. So this is a little weird. And, you know, after Election Day, if you want me, I'll just tell you what I think. Chen and Jorgensen and I wrote this piece. We had it on the Institute for New Economics Thinking website earlier on some graphs on the 2020 election. And one of them, we looked at the mobilization rates in 2018, which the Democrats won hugely there. And you could see this enormous mobilization of voters. And they really swamped the Republicans in 2018. Now, if you ask me, I think Biden has fallen into the same trap as the Hillary Clinton campaign did in 2016, which was to not say much to poorer people and to run. I mean, there was actually a study out of Harvard that claimed Hillary Clinton talked less about policy than any major party candidate since they had ever measured since, I think that was about 2002.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I was going to say, I think you're right because I just saw that Rahm Emanuel came out and said, 2020 is going to be the year of the Biden Republican. Definitely not looking at the poor.
No, that's right. The Biden campaign is trying to do two things, and they're completely contradictory. So there's lots of signs of strength. One is they can't hope to win without some fairly good support from the Sanders supporters. It's just not going to happen. They can easily replicate the 2016 result. Now, I should say here that we better specify what that 2016 result actually was. Now, I got so fed up with the literature that kept claiming that it was all race and gender that led to Trump's victory. I mean, it was obvious that it was race, gender, and economics to me. And so Paige and I and a couple other folks, we basically we just went in the American National Election Study and dug up the stuff ourselves. And you could see very plainly how issues like import protection and general economic dissatisfactions were in fact important in voting. And you could also see when you looked at how people changed from voting, typically from going from Obama voters to Trump voters, or just going from Obama voters to not voting, you know, if they couldn't see differences between the parties, they stayed away. They were more inclined. And a lot of people just said, oh, I don't necessarily like Trump. He wasn't that popular. It was an election between, if you like, the evil of two lessers.
Nobody. I want to comment on that if I could, not sure. To interrupt, but sure. In Johnstown, PA, I'm based out of Pittsburgh, as I told you before we started recording. In Johnstown, a lot of people voted for Trump. And, you know, journalists went there and asked them why. And they said, well, we don't really like Trump, and we don't think he's going to save us, but we don't like Hillary because, you know, it's the same old, same old. So I see what you're getting at there.
Yeah. So the end result was the Democrats just blew it on the, you know, they ran a personal campaign and, you know, did not have a great record bringing prosperity to a good chunk of the population that had been left out actually from 2008 and after in many cases. So they lost that election. Now, my guess is this time, this is a clinical assessment. It's not telling you I like it or anything like that. I suspect that the middle class movement against Trump is so huge, it will probably suffice to beat him. But I wouldn't bet the house on it. And you can see exactly as you suggested a few minutes ago, how the Biden campaign, Rahm Emanuel and company telling you we really want to attract Republicans. They are clearly, you can see there's open discussion of how they're not attracting Hispanic votes. Now, this is an exceedingly interesting question, and it needs to be handled with some subtlety. The framing in the mass media is almost entirely in terms of ethnicity and race. They just won't acknowledge people have slots in the economy there. But it's pretty obvious that a big chunk of the Hispanic vote in the Democratic Party went for Sanders. That's how he defeated Biden repeatedly in the parts of the West and out there. And he did well in some areas, you know, even where he would lose the state. And, you know, these folks need an issue. You got to talk to their problems. And they're not. At the moment, they're also not talking to the sort of poor white problems. Just telling you that I'm not Donald Trump is, you know, if you take that in its full depth of meaning, that's a really significant statement. I'm not trying to tell you there's not difference between the major parties. There is, but it's not going to percolate down to Main Street, if you like, and a lot of people will have a lot of trouble with it. The Biden people have made an unnecessary problem for themselves by bending over backwards to be, if you like, apparently conservative. They could blow it. I think they probably won't, but I'm not, you know, this is a real mess. They also, if you notice, and this scares me, there's two things going on that are absolutely clear here. One is there's a mammoth effort, just like in 2016, getting underway to save the Senate for the Republicans. Now, what Paige and I and our other colleagues found in our paper, we noticed that for the first time in American history, whoever won the presidential vote in his state in 2016, if there was a Senate election, that party also won the Senate seat. It was a perfect correlation. And what we found was, in just the voting thing, being in a state that had a Senate election and tended to up the Republican percentage of the vote. Now, not a lot, just a couple of percent or two. And, you know, it was a close election. Reverse coattails is what we call it. That paper is out in the International Journal of Political Economy, by the way. It's also an INET working paper in a different version, but basically the same. So you can see that's underway. So there may be a big spending undertow that helps pull Trump toward the end up. But I think I still think it's probably too little there.
So it's looking grim for Trump in the presidency, in your estimation.
Yeah. And that's generating a powerful current to push money out to Senate Republicans. But in 2016, that helped the Republican candidate for president in the final weeks. That's one point. The other thing is if you look at how the New York Times described the convention, and not only that, people like Nick Cohn, who should have known better. After the convention, they talked about how the race was shaping up as a referendum on just civil order, the disorder and things like that, and race. Anybody who sat and listened to Trump's speech knows there was a very strong economic component to it. It focused on the, we're going to bring back manufacturing. I'm going to make America great again. I was driving down the unemployment rate until COVID hit. And then he linked it to China and Chinese competition, and then said, oh, and by the way, Biden is, you know, really closely linked with all the decisions that have been bad to send jobs out of the United States.
In a way, it was vaguely reminiscent of like the Ross Perot campaign of the 90s.
Yeah, or Trump in 2016. I think that was that's basically a pitch I think got him a lot of votes. My bet is in the final stages of this election, you will again see those ads that ran. There were a number of them in 2016, including a famous one that was widely accused of being a closet anti-Semitic ad that would run with pictures of billionaires who were Jewish and things like that, and saying these people destroyed the United States and globalization. You're going to see more of that, but it almost doesn't matter. It's not like Biden has to be perceived personally as so much better than Trump. It's that the Trump thing is now perceived as so disastrous by a lot of people in the Bob Woodward book Revelations, while raising some questions about Woodward. You know, like, why did he hold on to it, you know, for so long? It's pretty devastating to find out this guy knew, just like Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, where that was clear, where he was at that point chair of what the Intelligence Committee, you know, he was telling the Tar Heel Donors Club one thing, this is really going to be bad. And he was telling the rest of the voters, including Republican voters in his state, that, oh, you know, it's everything's under control, it's fine. You know, Trump knew it all along, too. I think that's going to tell more. And my guess is you've been looking at these one sort of bombshell revelation of every 2 weeks for the last few. I think you'll probably see some more of them. I mean, that's where I'm sitting right now on this. I think it'll probably still work out for a Democratic victory, but don't bet the house on it. These are the Democrats. They can blow it at the last second. A fabled circular firing squad can be seen taking up positions from time to time. Rahm Emanuel, you quoted this perfect example.
I was going to say, in this regard, we see Trump sort of speaking out of both sides of his mouth. You know, he told us, oh, this COVID's going to go away. And then you find out in the Woodward revelations in the book Rage, no, he knew it was deadly. But we also see, I think, Biden speaking out of both sides of his mouth a little bit, or at least his team is, with regards to, on one hand, trying to appeal to progressives and people who want a Green New Deal. And on the other hand, saying to Wall Street, you know, we're going to have austerity. We're not going to raise taxes. What's going on with that?
Well, it's pretty, look, this is to repeat what happened in the Obama campaign. Now, here I do claim some, this was where the Delphic Oracle hit it right on the head. I had analyzed the early Obama money, and I wrote a piece. I think it came out in the spring of 2008, before Obama had the nomination completely sewn up. And I said, look, this guy is not a big reformer. This is Wall Street. I said it plain as day. and you're not going to see big financial reform. And, you know, when they got in, you didn't. It was fun to watch the way the original blog thing, which had published that, it was a sort of pro-democratic site. They got rid of the thing before the 2012 election. And Eve Smith at Naked Capitalism, bless her heart, put it back up there. But the same type of maneuver is going on again. The tension between the mass base and the money is overwhelming. And you can see Ted Kaufman in the middle of the convention telling the donors, look, we know we can't spend very much. And then he had to walk it back when AOC picked up on it. I mean, I could wish that the sort of AOC and colleagues, I think they could do with a bit sharper economics in some of their analysis, but that's their thing. I mean, that it's not, you know, I'm not in the business of giving advice to candidates, but it's perfectly obvious that the Biden thing is going to be hold the line. He's going to have to raise taxes. And, you know, after the Trump tax cut, yeah, it's just ridiculous. They're going to try to hold the line on that. I think it's clear they will repeat many of the Obama mistakes. If you notice, this happened twice, not once, and we're going for the third time now. When Clinton came in, you may remember, I mean, it took about a week. I actually wrote this up in Golden Rule, where they got rid of all talk about single-payer health within a week when the two major unions supporting it just basically took down all the stuff on support. They got rid of that. And then they went off on, you know, healthcare and think not the economy. And they got smashed in the 94 elections. Exactly the same thing, except much worse, occurred in 2010 under Obama, where they failed to do anything like the fiscal stimulus of the size they should have. And, you know, now we may face the same type of situation under Biden. It's going to be interesting. From my outside vantage point, I'm not talking to anybody. It looks like a Noah's Ark strategy in terms of Biden external campaign. They have a joint committee on everything with Sanders stuff. Then they've got their own folks inside. Those people will dominate the inside. They will dominate the change, the transition period, if they win.
In regards to, I guess, what could be called that more progressive or economically left wing of the Democratic Party, they weren't able to really win with Bernie. And you mentioned, you know, we've seen a lot of this before with regards to Obama and past administrations within the Democratic Party and the sort of Democrats' right-wing turn. Is there any possibility of the AOC-Bernie wing turning the tide at all, or do you see that as being unlikely?
Well, if you ask me, you know, I often tell people, look, if you want a happy ending, see a Disney movie. But I'm not pushing that line. They're doing much better than I thought, and they have continued to do well. Look, if you had told me in 2016 that Bernie Sanders would emerge, defeat Hillary Clinton in primary after primary and win, you know, enormous numbers of votes, I'd have said, you're out of your mind. And I actually think that the sort of dual economy in the United States, the split between top and bottom, has gotten so enormous that the Band-Aids won't do the job. And so the real problem will be events and reality. I keep telling people don't want to hear this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I mean, all this postmodern stuff, which is really all about how experts define the world, that stuff is basically just close enough to the truth to be seriously misleading. Because, you know, when COVID showed up, the experts could talk all they want. It just went through and killed a lot of people. Similarly, the recession is really damaging a lot of people. And the Federal Reserve response, which, you know, in coordination with the Treasury, the parts of the various relief bills where the Treasury backstops the losses of the Fed, which can't take losses, that's the key to the policy that they can do. This stuff is intensifying. I mean, almost every tendency you can think of out of the economy, the tendency to monopolize bigger sectors, particularly in the information sector, and just swallow small businesses, thereby just charging them too much to get any ads and things like that. That stuff is intensifying. You're exacerbating the way you tell people, okay, work from home. You know, most poor people can't work from home.
Yeah, there's only a privileged few that really get to do the work
it's
from
not
home.
A few. It's about 40%. I've taken all the numbers.
Right.
About 38-40% of the workforce. And then you've got all these people, you know, who are actually offering care to folks. OSHA has just disappeared. I actually think I'm somewhat disappointed that the Democrats haven't made more out of it than they have. You got huge chunks of the population still hugely exposed. It's true that the death rates have dropped a lot from COVID, you know, but the infection rates are still out of control. They might as well be wildfires in the West. You know, and that's of course another problem. But you're looking here at most of the, if you like, the intensifying disjunction between top and bottom. It's getting worse.
Do you think there's a relation between this intensification and the sort of, I guess, would have been called social upheavals? I think a lot of times people are ignoring that these protests around Black Lives Matter are happening during a time when there's unemployment and a lot of economic uncertainty. Do you think there's a connection there?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I thought that from the beginning. It's also important to note there's a Mike Elk's Payday site.
Mike is great, yeah.
Yeah, he has been tabulating wildcat strikes. I believe I'm correct when I say I think they're now over 1,000. It's striking to me how little echo there is in the press of that. And I think there is abundant evidence of real trouble. Though, again, I want to make the point where this will really bite is when you defeat Democratic incumbents under the assumption that Biden defeats Trump. I mean, I have written a number of papers in German economic history. You know, I just tell people, when they ask me, what do you like about the Democrats? I say, well, I don't like them that much, but you know what? I support Hindenburg. I'm voting for Biden, period. That's the end of it. But I try not to let that influence my assessment of things. I mean, a big problem with political commentary right now is that you can see, it shows very clearly in polling data, you ask people about the state of the economy, you can predict their response based on their party affiliation. That suggests you're getting into deep doublethink, as my old friend Ed Herman used to say. And you got to do something about this. But yeah, no, we're looking at a real mess. But I it's not clear to me that it's all a lost cause. I do think Jorgensen Chen and I wrote this up in our study of 2012 election, which we had just were publishing that paper just as the stuff came out about Snowden. And then we noticed that, hey, you know what? The Snowden revelations concern a bunch of guys, you know, it's all Silicon Valley. These guys are all for Obama. You can see a big chunk of Silicon Valley over for Biden here. And these folks are clearly promoting, to be blunt, the surveillance state. They just don't care about privacy. They get the lip service to it, but, you know, and this is not going to get better. People are going to have to sort of think about this. I saw where a former intelligence official went on the board of Amazon just recently. That's remarkable. That needs some more querying. And that was right as Amazon's, one of their senior people had resigned earlier in the year saying they didn't care about worker safety. I mean, they need
I actually had the one Amazon whistleblower on, Chris Smalls, who was working at that warehouse when the COVID thing broke out and they weren't giving them PPE and all this other stuff. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Well, the whole that, one assumes they have gotten somewhat better. But the failure on COVID to protect people and the fact that you still can't buy cheap N95 masks easily is crazy. I mean, and what's more, there are all these efforts to shut down medical whistleblowers. It bothers me a lot that, like, I happen to know the doctor who was the first person fired, I think, out of a U.S. hospital for saying in public that his staff was not adequately protected. And, you know, they got, I'm sure, lawsuits and things are going, but this is crazy. And I think the whole Democratic Party ought to be ashamed that they have not championed a much stronger whistleblower law and stuff like that.
In regards to getting around all of this and sort of tying it all together, there was a report about a week ago came out from a Deutsche Bank strategist saying that we are sort of coming up against a potential age of disorder. But this Deutsche Bank strategist was saying that this age of disorder would be sort of social upheavals against the investment class and whatnot. Do you think that's in store in the future?
It's as characteristically, this stuff is overwrought. Now, I spent a long time looking at archives in the 1930s. If you read, like, the, say, some of the DuPont executives, I remember a paper by, I think it was R.R. Carpenter, I forget. Anyway, one of their top guys was talking about how everything was over in the United States for the rich and you should think about emigrating and stuff like that. That was in the late 30s. Now, nothing like that materialized. Quite the contrary. They all came roaring back during World War II and after. So I think you have to deal with the fact that there is a kind of crazy, I mean, you know, technically it's a sort of bent for a psychological state that is not pure rational state at all. They get hugely nervous asymmetrically, as the saying goes, when there appears to be a threat. You can see this all over. Just look at the gold price. That gold price is mostly folks saying, oh my God, Europe's in trouble. The U.S. is in trouble. No, I don't want to hold a lot of yen. I'm not going to buy a lot of renminbi, which you couldn't do if you wanted to anyway. So you get these sort of panic fears among investor blocks are well known. They also usually can sort out fact from frenzy, though it can take a while. This is exactly like the New Deal, where, you know, Roosevelt, most of Roosevelt's money in the 36th reelection came from the business community and the free trade and capital intensive sectors of it. It did not come from labor unions. They did give for the first time. They created an enormous shockwave around Pittsburgh, was particularly, by the way, quite a shock. But, you know, everybody's overwrought right now. And people, in these moments when you're sort of living in an interregnum, you can see things are, tectonic plates are shifting. Everybody starts projecting pretty wild stuff into the future. I'm not convinced that you'll have the sort of the convulsive reaction. You can see it in the sense that people are on their guard, but it's not as crazy, I think, in behavior as it is in rhetoric.
So
it's after all cheap.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it does seem like there's at least this sense of frenzy. I know the World Economic Forum is doing a summit, I believe, next year called the Great Reset. It sounds like there's more talk of reforms, but whether that'll happen, it seems like it's up in the air.
It didn't happen after 2008 and 10. I'm not expecting to see a lot. I mean, let's talk about that for a few minutes, if I could. One problem with the money, people have to understand the connection between political money and reform now. People look back on the progressive era, which I'm going to wave aside two libraries full of books and just say that's roughly from about 1904 or so down to World War I, and then a revival in the Depression with Roosevelt. But the progressive era tended to be led by local politicians, the La Follettes in Wisconsin, Charles Evans Hughes, who I can barely take seriously as a progressive, but he was one. He was very close to the Rockefellers, and I have seen the letter where the chairman of Standard Oil of New Jersey said he wanted to push Hughes for president again in 1920, which he was not able to do. And then folks in Kansas City and elsewhere, there were governors typically, and these people would do governors and local politicians, including, you know, state senators and rep, and big efforts to change the Senate election procedures to get it out of state legislatures. Now, the point to understand about those is that a huge chunk of the political money was local and did actually sometimes come, as things got really ridiculous, from the same type of upper middle class folks who are not rich, that often, you know, when you study the Sanders campaign, I think that's what I see there. People who are not in the 1% know things are ridiculous. Well, the thing about political money is essentially it's national centralization. You could see this. The story I told in an essay in a book about 10 or 12 years ago. In the 70s, there were some serious efforts to regulate political money. What actually ended up was almost immediately they were undone. And they were undone not just by the Republicans, but by the Democrats. And it's not me, but it's a guy at Ohio State in Poli Sci who wrote a fine paper that just shows you what happened there is the Democratic leadership was realizing that they needed more money than they thought the unions, which they could see were declining, could provide. So they started changing the rules. And soon you got, you know, the limits went off. I mean, it's a mistake to overemphasize that Citizens United decision as sort of the basis of money, even though I see it done all the time. You have had close to unlimited amounts of money floating around in American politics in the 80s, so-called soft money stuff, 90s, and then the so-called 527 stuff. I mean, vast sums of cash went in there. Now, here's the point. The Democrats also changed the seniority system. They finally got rid of it, which was quite correctly held to privilege Southern Democrats who sat in there forever and ended up dominating the Congress, especially the Senate, and making it a good deal more conservative. So what representatives then started doing was they wanted to run for chairmanships and things like that. And so they actually started giving each other money. It was a sort of, you know, you'd think you were in with the anthropologists and the Quacky Oodles or something. Everybody sending cash out there. So soon you get a market inside Congress. Then as Gingrich goes to topple the Republican leadership, he builds this enormous fundraising machine, mostly outside the rules and mostly outside the Congress. He builds this thing. And when they come in 94, Tom DeLay, the Hammer and others, there's a nice biography of DeLay by, let's see, Lou DeBose, I think, where he just tells you that they were sitting there when people would come in and apply for committee chairs and things, they had printouts of how much money had you raised for them. And the Republicans centralized that from the congressional campaigns in the hands of the leadership. The Democrats did exactly the same thing. They got to the point of actually having a Sears catalog for a while. There were actually sort of printed prices. If you wanted to be the chairman of this or that, you had to raise this kind of cash. I mean, Pelosi won the leadership by outraising Steny Hoyer. And what's happened, therefore, is you get a national centralization of political money. It's a much more top-down process. And so you get the big media talking to the big donors, talking to the party top. And this will sound crazy, but it's true. You can't actually dial for dollars from your office. So the party, it's illegal. So you need someplace in Washington close at hand to do that, because people spend a lot of time on the phone. And so the parties have these offices out just outside the Capitol where you can go. Well, you can't get access to that stuff unless the party leaders give it to you. So it's just much harder. I mean, ask the AOC people who probably don't do most of their stuff in those rooms. So what you've got, therefore, is a much more top-down system in which a great deal more political money than it looks comes through centralized processes. Add to that on the Republican side, but not the Democratic side, these operations like ALEC, that state organizations that in effect sort of give you prefabricated built drafts of bills and things like that. And you see a lot more top-down control of all political money. And that's why that linear model of campaign expenses, I think, in the end has worked out, although that model predates. They were getting those results before that happened, though most of the period we cover in our paper on House and Senate fundraising and outcomes dates from after the reform, the Democratic reform, which so the process is in motion there. It's a process, not an event. Anyway, bottom line on this is you can see how people, where governors who now have to contend with these big fundraising machines, so-called 527s, National Republican Governors Association, National Democratic Governors, and also state attorneys general have to do that. This really chokes. It makes it much harder to be a progressive and survive. I mean, there's many fewer people talking now or willing to talk, I think, than there would have been, say, in, I'm going to make it up, 1912. I mean, the inter-party debates are much less. And you get guys like, you know, Rahm Emanuel and people like that, just virtually treating anybody who dissents as traitors. And that's that. I mean, this is really a problem. People have not caught up with the reality here. It's why I give AOC and her colleagues a lot of credit for that. I mean, that's exactly the type of thing that needs to happen.
Well, in closing, and I know you have to get going here, I just want to clarify one thing. When we're talking about money in politics and efforts to get money out of politics, this big political money, I just want to clarify, you don't hold the view that some people do. There's this vulgar idea that, oh, you know, there's like the shadowy financiers at the top, like 12 people who fund both candidates. That's not what you're saying. There's different sectors of finance.
I was a strong critic of so-called spider web theories, which are now being given a high-tech reformation in network theory, where everybody's connected to everybody else. I just tell people, I've had this debate with, you got to put dollar signs on those. So a lot of those connections are almost close to meaningless. No, the real issue is competition within the business community. And how does that interact with social class conflict and the organization of parts of, you know, social classes? I mean, in other words, racial and ethnic groups and how they figure in the division of labor. That's what your problem is. And no, it's exactly not. You don't have a group of people at the top controlling everything. That's not what I'm telling you. And no, I think macroeconomics, exchange rates, they really set policy parameters that folks have to adjust to. You can also adjust them. But no, this is, I keep telling people that you need to understand competition within the business community. In Europe, you get a lot of old orthodox Marxism. You have less of it here. But you get where it just says it's all workers versus capitalists. You can't go anywhere empirically with that. The reason you can't, as I explained in my old articles on this, is labor's been too weak to actually organize its own political party.
So it's almost like it's capitalists versus other capitalists in ways with this.
There money. Is, but they have to fit into a structure of social conflict and acquiescence that has itself something you can analyze. And that's not something they can help shape it, but they can't control it.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If there's anything else you want to throw out there in closing, I always like to end on a positive note, but dark times.
Thank you very much. I've quite enjoyed it, and I'm very happy to do it. Sometime I'm glad to come back. We can, when there are more facts out there and after elections, I love to just go over this stuff, but it takes a while. Anyway, thank you very much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Thomas Ferguson. If you can, check out his classic book, Golden Rule: The Investment Theory of Party Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Gratz, Zach, Ted, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit, like those listeners, then consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. $10 and $15
$5 tier subscribers get a producer's credit on each and every edition of the program. And at the $5 tier, you get the Parallax Views current events program, the week that was, in which yours truly and my pal, Comrade Casey, discuss the latest in current events and political shenanigans. So again, please, 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 if you love the program, if you even just like it a little bit, consider supporting me on Patreon.com at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.